This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's Radio Free Radio.
Welcome to Face to Face. This is a show about change and about what's next. It's a show that wants to ask questions, peel back the layers of our average everyday experience, and go beyond scratching the surface. We interview amazing people with incredible ideas and stories who have done wild, weird, and wonderful things. Remember that imagination shared creates collaboration, and collaboration creates community, and community inspires social change. I'm David Peck, and this is Face to Face. So welcome to Face to Face, another edition. I have no idea what number this is going to turn out to be, but we have a lovely guest with us today, Carly Sapoznik from the Alliance Against Modern Slavery. Thanks for joining us.
You're welcome. It's a pleasure to be with you today.
So we're Carly and I met a couple years ago, I think, at a conference. I'm not even sure where actually now. We'd have to tease that out a little bit. But the work that Carly does and her personality, in a way, don't add up. She's got a great smile, she's fun to chat with, and yet here she is working on some pretty serious issues. We just, before hitting the record button, we've been talking a little bit about her PhD she's working on and her organization, which is the Alliance Against Modern Slavery. And if you want to check out the website, even as you're listening, it's allianceagainstmodernslavery.org. It's the full 9 yards there. You got to spell it out. And check out the website and find out some of the work that the organization's doing as we chat. And I'm going to let Carly tell you a little bit more about that, but it's a pretty sensitive topic, a pretty important topic, a lot going on here. And I think you're going to probably be surprised by some of the things you find out today. So again, Carly, thanks for joining us. And so tell us a little bit about the Alliance and maybe why there's such an organization in Canada.
Well, we have 3 co-founders, myself and 2 others, and back in 2009, 2 of us went to a conference in England. And at that time, there was no organization in Canada that was nonpartisan and non-denominational doing work to combat slavery. We met Kevin Bales of Free the Slaves and others at the Wilberforce Institute for Studies on Slavery and Emancipation, and we were blown away. My colleague Jeff Gunn and I, we were studying historical anti-slavery. We had both written our master's thesis on that topic. And here we were learning about contemporary slavery and the fact that there are 27 million people that we estimate are in slavery today, even though it has been legally abolished across our planet.
So here you are at a conference in England, having spent most of your time looking at the history of slavery, not really aware of what's going on currently. And so when you say blown away, you mean, wow, it was kind of one of those holy smokes moments that I didn't have any idea that this was going on.
Absolutely. Yeah. I also, a year before that, had met a young woman who really changed my life. And her example is one of a forced marriage, which is one of the forms of modern-day slavery today, at the age of 14 years old.
Wow.
Her family, unfortunately, her mother had passed away, giving birth to her younger brother. And after the civil war in Somalia, they had moved to Kenya. Her father remarried, and they were really struggling. They needed food. They didn't have good shelter. And so one of the strategies that was used in that case was to actually sell her in the form of a marriage. And so her stepmother strongly encouraged this, and they pulled her out of school. They told her that she did not have a choice. She tried to run away. Unfortunately, she was found. Her brother then beat her very badly to the point where she really could no longer resist. And then the ceremony took place. The forced husband was 53 years old.
She was 14.
14, that's wow. Correct.
And this is in Canada?
Or this was in... She was taken to Uganda. The ceremony occurred in Kenya. And we know this story because she eventually was able to get help from the United Nations headquarters in Kampala, Uganda. And one of our programs in Canada has a certain quota for individuals who have faced this type of torture. And she then came to Toronto, and I met her at the Canadian Center for Victims of Torture here.
in Toronto, Canada. Wow.
Yeah, see, I mean, it's sobering. I mean, it's sobering material to be talking about. It's the kind of thing that, you know, and here have I been doing this kind of work for many years in development and so on, and when I hear stories like this, I say, really? Is this really, A, is it really going on in the world? Always remarkable to hear stories like that. And then to say that it's actually, like, there's a center for torture here in Canada, you just kind of go, hang on, that's supposed to happen in other parts of the world, not here. Mm-hmm. Right? It's more than sobering. So is this, so you met her before the Alliance started as well?
That's right.
Was that the seed for you, would you say?
It definitely was the seed.
Yeah.
And I, again, as I mentioned, I was doing work on historical anti-slavery.
Sure.
Which is this really interesting, I think, part of our history. Most of the tools we use today in our human rights movements are connected to that first movement where you had the creation of boycotts and petitions and large-scale movements with local committees. And so for me, it was a really fascinating time in history. You also have the French Revolution in that period, and new ideas about freedom and equality, and even the first feminist movement where women who were involved in anti-slavery started to ask themselves, well, hold on a second here. We're talking about liberty and equality and freedom, yet we don't have those things.
Right.
And so it was shocking to me again because in theory, slavery has been legally abolished everywhere.
Right.
But then not only did I find out about this one case about a forced marriage, and there was marriage trafficking involved because she was taken across from Kenya to Uganda, but I also discovered that human trafficking, one of the other forms of modern-day slavery, was thriving here in Canada as well. And I quickly discovered that it wasn't just thriving in BC or on the East Coast, but it was also happening in my hometown and actually literally in my backyard in Winnipeg. I had the chance to do some surveillance with the team in Manitoba, and my sister and I also, she joined us and one of our colleagues with the Alliance, and we saw that young girls were being bought for sex. And it was right next to my grandfather's house.
So there was a brothel next door? Is that
It was outside.
Yeah.
So about 20% of sexual exploitation and sex trafficking of children and minors happens outdoors. So they were being picked up and they were being, they were charging money. And then that money was then being given to their pimps, or in one case, it was the father of the young girl. And for me, it was shocking, not only because it was happening right on one of the main streets next to my grandfather's house, but it was happening in a lot larger numbers than I had ever thought as well. And the individuals who were purchasing the sex were not the individuals that you necessarily think of as bad people.
Right, right. Which I guess is typically when you think of sex trafficking, you think of... I mean, in the last few years, there have been some films that have been made. Generally, these are not nice people. Mm-hmm. Or at least those are the images. Or you think of, criminals, hardened criminals. But so what you're saying is these are kind of regular folk in a way? Is that...
Regular folk, yeah. On average, it tends to be men who have some disposable income. That's the only thing that they have in common. And they can be teachers. They can be lawyers. They can be doctors of all ethnicities and cultures. In other cases, we have seen women as well. One of the first charges in Manitoba was of a woman who was operating out of a shelter, who is using that position of power to take advantage of young, vulnerable, at-risk youth.
So how, I mean, I'm all over the place right now. I've got about 32 different questions I want to ask you, but you've studied slavery from a historical perspective. We kind of know what that means. Mm-hmm. It's African. It's about rubber plantations. It's about coffee. It's about all these things. It's about bringing slaves into the West and so on. Mm-hmm. How do you define modern slavery? And let me just toss this out here too, Carly. Just this week, somebody sent me an email that had one of those PowerPoint presentations to it that says, "Hey, we live in a better world than we used to," and one of the slides says there's less slavery today than there was 10 years ago. I don't know if that's true, and I'm interested to hear what you have to say about that. So there's about three questions in there.
I'll tackle the first one first. When it comes to defining slavery, we adhere to a sociological definition that's advanced by Kevin Bales. And so for it to count as slavery, you need three things. First of all, someone who is forced to work without any pay.
Okay.
So here I'm not talking about wage slavery, or even someone who's earning as little as $1 or $2 a day.
So we're not talking about a sweatshop at this point?
No.
Necessarily?
Not necessarily.
Okay.
So someone who's forced to work without any pay. Second thing is they're under the threat or the use of violence. That threat piece is really important because when we talk to survivors here in Canada, for instance, there was a big Hungarian case recently, a forced labor case in Hamilton, Ontario, in a suburban neighborhood where 19 men who came over from Hungary, who were promised work in the construction industry, were then forced to work 18-hour days. They weren't paid at all. And the reason why many of them explained later on, what held them in there was the fact that there were threats being made by the traffickers back home against their loved ones, saying, oh, it would be a shame if something were to happen to your daughter, to your wife.
Right.
And so often that threat of the violence is what is even more powerful than the violence itself that could be perpetrated against someone.
Sure.
So you've got forced work without any pay. Second thing, under the threat of use of violence. And the third thing is unable to walk away. Whether it's a language issue or a safety issue, whatever it might be, those are the three things that we see for it to count as a case of slavery. And under that definition, the global estimate is about 27 million people. The major myth, I think, in Canada right now is that...
27 million people. What's Canada's population? 32?
Canada, so it's about the size of our population of Canada in the early 1990s. Yeah. So if you want to picture Canada, that's
isn't
somewhat
that wild?
Accurate.
We're all slaves.
Yeah. And one of the big myths here, though, is that we have 27 million human trafficking victims. But human trafficking represents only about 20% of that total. Modern slaves today. The largest form still remains debt bondage. And we have about 10 million people alone in India who are in what we call debt bondage.
Right. So can you give me I was going to say the Coles Notes version. I just dated myself. Debt bondage is...
it's a scenario where, I'll give you an example. Let's say you have a family in India where, unfortunately, the father, he gets ill. And the mother is trying to do her best to feed the family, but just doesn't have the income to support them. She needs to pay for medication. And then you have the moneylender in the town or the village, wherever it might be, who will agree to give her a loan. But then he'll say, in some cases, first of all, there's going to be huge amounts of interest. But then the key thing in some cases is that he will give her the loan if he then can own her.
Right.
And the problem with that is how can you ever repay someone if they own you?
Right.
And unfortunately, what we see is entire villages are in this situation where the debt is also inherited because it could be as little as $20 Canadian, but they can never repay that. And the interest keeps accruing. And then the father and mother pass on, and then their children inherit that, and then their grandchildren, and so on.
So number three for you in the definition, no pay, threat of violence, and you can't walk. How do you ultimately walk away? And I don't mean maybe necessarily the individuals, but I guess the question is, how do you break this chain of violence? And sorry for the metaphor, but how does it get any better? It sounds like it's actually getting worse. You know, I mean, it sounds like it's becoming more refined almost in a way. And, you know, is this one of the downsides of globalization? You know, or is there an upside to this? Because we can tweet about this now. We can have conferences about this and so on. So maybe that's an upside to it. But I guess right now I'm just hearing, wow, this is way maybe worse than I thought. And I think that most of our listeners will have heard of before. How do you start to break the chain?
I think, as you said, the tweeting and education piece is essential. Both here and in that small village in India.
Right.
So we've got in Canada, it's really important that all of us start to ask, well, where is that t-shirt I'm wearing coming from? Or if it's something else, even a rug, for example, because we're all connected through globalization, as you mentioned, and slavery is what Hillary Clinton has called the dark underbelly of globalization.
Right.
Where education also is key is, as I said, within that village itself. And so there are groups that now are working with, we're really against working for. We really believe in collaboration and a grassroots model. And we see entire villages, once they're given that knowledge that this is illegal, come together, not on their own, but together as a unit. And then they are facing the moneylenders and the authorities, and great organizations like Free the Slaves are doing this work, and then now whole villages are in freedom. And it's not that expensive either. That's a lot of people think, well, this is so huge in terms of the scale and scope. But financially speaking, on average for one family in India, it costs about $800 for counseling, rehabilitation, and job training, so that these individuals are not going to be re-enslaved or vulnerable.
Do you think that a lot of these people who are holding other people in bondage, the Hamilton example, you know, the threats of, oh, wouldn't it be a shame if your daughter or wife, do you think they actually really would follow through? Are they that violent, or is there a small portion of the population that would actually succumb to that kind of immoral kind of behavior, crimes, frankly?
Well, it's hard to say. I think it really depends on the individual, but we have certainly seen quite a bit of violence, especially within the sex trafficking cases. Mm. And in the Hamilton case, there were even death threats made against some of the service providers, some of our politicians in Canada, and a headhunter was even hired to kill some of them. So I think we should take those threats seriously and that risk of...
No, it just makes me wonder, you know, kind of more bark than they are bite. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. I mean, I just wonder if it's a threat that... And you know, having not ever sat in that kind of a situation, you know, other than maybe being bullied a little bit as a kid, you know, you can't really, imagine the impact that kind of threat. You're far away from home, you're not getting paid any money, you've essentially got no freedom. Who do you go to, right? You don't speak the language and so on. And it's hard to imagine these kinds of issues without actually kind of walking in somebody else's shoes. So is that what the Alliance is there for? Is it all about education then for you guys?
That's one of the pieces. Our mission is four-pronged. It's to research, to educate, and to aid in partnership in our local and global communities. So about 50% of our work is local and 50% of our work is global. And we think that's really key. The research that we do informs the education and the aid, and our partnerships also in turn inform what we research that then goes back and informs the education and the aid.
One of the greatest books I've read, period, is a book called King Leopold's Ghost. And I know a little bit about the history of slavery and so on. And it's a book that my brother recommended I read. Oh, you got to read it. It's amazing, et cetera, et cetera. I finished it in a few days, actually. I mean, it reads like an incredible piece of fiction. Like Adam Hochschild is the writer. If you haven't read it out there, you really do need to pick it up. And it's essentially an extension of Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness. It's got connections, obviously, to the film Apocalypse Now and so on. So that was slavery then, this idea that we actually were kidnapping people from their homeland and bringing them elsewhere to make them work for either nothing or next to nothing. Is that still going on?
It is going on in certain places. We still have what you would think of as traditional slavery. For example, in Mali, Africa, it's hereditary in that case, but we still see individuals working on plantations or a cotton field. And in that case, we have about 800,000 people in the north of Mali, which is about the size of Winnipeg for people to picture.
Right.
And the status is inherited, so you're born into it, and your children are taken away from you at early ages. They're often forced into marriages. And in some cases, it's entirely based on racial discrimination. The Temashek language there in the north of Mali, the words black and slave are actually synonymous, which I think tells you a lot about some of the legacies there. But in other cases, slavery has evolved, and it looks very different than it used to. And so that's where I think a lot of the movement now is focusing on human trafficking, which takes the form of what may look like to outsiders in some cases as prostitution.
Right.
Or in some other cases, as I mentioned, it can involve a marriage, and it may look like an arranged marriage to an outsider. But if individuals aren't able to give their free and full consent, then that's not what we would call an arranged marriage.
So to rewind a little bit to that PowerPoint presentation of, you know, what a better world we live in today, it was very much seen through a Western set of eyes. You know, when you look at all the wonderful things that have happened, that this, you know, friend of mine sent me this presentation, you know, slavery is not as bad as it used to be. Is that, do you think, what they're talking about, that classical definition of chaining somebody to the bottom of a boat and they're rowing you home. Is that mm-hmm. why whoever created this PowerPoint can say that?
In a way, in terms of the numbers, they are probably right. If you look at even ancient Greece, about 50% of the population was enslaved.
Right.
Today, if we're estimating, and again, these estimates are in some cases very conservative because of the nature of slavery today, the fact that it's no longer illegal, everything's covert. So it makes it very difficult for researchers to estimate this.
Yeah.
But if you take 27 million out of our population of over 7 billion, that works out to being 0.03%,
right.
Which is substantially less than ever before in our history. And
so if
we look based just purely based on the numbers, then your friend is right, probably.
Right. So I just recently got home from Cambodia. I spent a couple of weeks there and I'm doing a lot more research on the country itself and seeing where it's heading economically. And it looks like they're on the edge of discovering quite a few resources, minerals. They've discovered oil off the coast of Sihanoukville. And of course, there's probably a battle that's going to go on about who owns that and in the South China Sea and who's going to pick it up corporately, et cetera. Will it actually benefit just a small group of people or the country itself? And then there's all kinds of, it seems, extractive companies slowly coming in, but the whole land right thing is a real problem, et cetera. So there's probably gold there. There's probably copper. There's, maybe we're on the edge. So I'm talking to my son about this and very fun, interesting, cute conversation. He's 7 years old and he thinks we should go and open up a mine in Cambodia. And so we talked just recently on the weekend and he made some comment about how we'll probably need some really good shovels, which is just hysterical, right?
Yeah.
That we're just going to dig this small hole and actually find gold and not really realizing multi-billion dollar industry that we're talking about. Anyway, I thought something he said was really interesting and I did not prompt him at all. We were talking about exploitation and about how, and I've just commented a little bit about in the mining industry, this can happen and so on. And he came back with, well, what he thought would be a good idea was whoever discovered the gold would get 50% of it. And then the 50% would go to the company that was kind of, this is a 7-year-old's understanding of capitalism. He probably has a better understanding than I do, actually. But I thought it was really interesting, and I want to connect it to, do we lose that somewhere along the way? I mean, do you think that slavery today, modern slavery, is connected somehow to this, dare I say it, exploitative nature behind capitalism? This idea that I want to benefit at your expense. So you've got your sweatshops. You have your anti-living wage, not your living wage. And so you have a roof collapse in Bangladesh, and I put my Quicksilver shirt on in the morning. I put my Joe Fresh clothing on. I don't give a rat's ass about Bangladesh, really, because I continue to feed into this industry. And yet at the same time, you interview a lot of those people in Bangladesh, they don't want to give that job up.
Mm-hmm.
So again, I'm talking out loud, but I think there's a few questions embedded here. How is it that my son at 7 can be so generous mm-hmm. and in about 10 years' time maybe be running a small little backyard business exploiting his friends mm-hmm. and then in another 10 years, mm-hmm. in the financial industry making tons of money? And not that there's anything necessarily wrong with that intrinsically, but I think there's something connected there. Because I want to ask that question, how does somebody exploit another human being in such mm-hmm. a mm-hmm. horrific kind of a way? Sorry,
that's a great question. There's a huge debate in the literature right now on that very thing, whether or not there is this explicit link to capitalism. And there's this one famous man named Eric Williams wrote a book called Slavery and Capitalism, which suggested just that was the thesis he put forward, that with the rise of capitalism that we see an increased amount of slavery and through that connection, that's what has motivated even the work of humanitarian groups. However, it seems that his theory, while it's attractive and there are some great points, it doesn't explain the anti-slavery movement at all.
Right.
And so you have,
because it's coming out of the same culture.
Same culture. Eric Williams was actually in Trinidad and Tobago, and he didn't take into account the fact that in that period, in the late 18th, early 19th century, slavery was equivalent to the car industry, if you will.
Okay.
And so when the first group of anti-slavery campaigners put forward their call to legally abolish it, they were looked at as if they were crazy. You know, 9 out of 10 people thought they were nuts.
Yeah.
But the British actually invested a huge percentage of their budget on a national level over years to actually ensure that ships carrying slaves were going to be taken off the oceans. And you see that within 20 years, people who are motivated more by humanitarian rationales and by justice are putting this forward.
And these probably would have been capitalists of the time and socialists of the time and religious folk mm-hmm. and non-religious folk. Mm-hmm. It would have been groups of all sort of or people from all different groups.
Right.
Yeah.
So you on one level you see that there is this certain link between slavery and capitalism, but then you also see that the movements that have ensured the abolition and now what we see the decline hopefully in slavery are not at all motivated by that.
So where does the moral fiber come from then? So where does the moral fiber come from for somebody to say, this is unacceptable and I want to see this change? You know, in King Leopold's mm-hmm. Ghost, I tell the story when I speak publicly often about Edmund Dean Morrill, the guy who saw the ships coming into Antwerp in Belgium loaded with slaves and rubber and coffee and resources, essentially, and going out with soldiers and guns and so mm-hmm. on to the Congo. Hey, something doesn't add up here, says Edmund. And he ends up becoming one of the first human rights activists, mm-hmm. I mean, that we know of, started the Congo Reform Association, and the list goes on what this guy did. Mm-hmm. So why him and not somebody else, you know?
Usually the tipping point for most people is when they have a personal experience.
Okay.
So someone like, if you look at, there's a famous song, Amazing Grace, that was written by former slave ship captain John Newton.
Yeah.
And so most people, they think of that as a song about hope, but the lyrics, I once was lost, but now I'm found, I once was blind, but now I see, they also referred to his views and how they changed about the slave trade. He transshipped about 20,000 Africans from Sierra Leone at the time, and then later in life realized that what he had done is wrong. And so he, having had these personal experiences and witnessing the way that these individuals were treated, could no longer just look the other way. And I think for most people today in Canada, we have a sense, some of these things that we're buying, you know, maybe it's at a dollar store or at the grocery store. How is it that we can possibly pay so little for this? But we don't necessarily want to think a step further because that makes us uncomfortable. And then that may mean that we will have to change something.
Right.
And so I think making sure that people can have that experience, a personal one, on some level, is really key.
So do you want people to stop shopping at dollar stores, or do you want people to think about what they're doing when they're shopping at a dollar store? Is that better?
We want people to think about what they're doing when they're shopping, and also, whenever possible, to do what we call boycotting. So let's say you're already in public or you're at a friend's place and they've already made a great dinner and dessert. At that point, you know, you're not going to not eat the chocolate in whatever. Maybe it's a chocolate cake because it's not slavery free, right? But if you're the one at the shopping store or at the dollar store, make an informed decision and you know, do your research. There are some great sites. One of our partners is called Choco Soul, and they're based here in Toronto, and their chocolate is slavery free. They know exactly where the cocoa beans are coming from. But there are a number of other options that you can choose from for many products, including your laptop, your cell phone, just basic fruits and vegetables as well. And so we're not saying completely end it, but whenever you can, think about where it's coming from and make that choice that is more ethical and more moral.
Ask some questions.
Absolutely. And send our corporations a message that we're not going to tolerate cutting corners. So, for example, Cadbury now has a chocolate bar. They have one that's fair trade, the milk chocolate bar.
I just saw on the weekend Tim Hortons is now advertising not fair trade coffee, but at least, you know, equitable trade, I suppose they would call it. They would call it, you know, and it's a big advertising campaign. You can buy this now at Tim Hortons. Article in the Globe on Saturday about Cambodian living wage and young women and how a lot of them are younger than 15 years old. Front page of the Globe and Mail. I mean, 10 years ago, we probably wouldn't have been having this discussion in the news media. I mean, you would have seen it here and there, but not, I don't think, to the degree that it's going on today. So in that sense, would you say, you're hopeful?
I am hopeful.
Yeah.
I think even just 5 years ago when we used to tell people about slavery, they looked at us like we were crazy.
Right.
And now, 5 years later, they're saying, oh, you know, I saw this movie and I read this book. And so the awareness is growing. And I think similar to the MAD campaign when it comes to drinking and driving, when it was first launched, a lot of people thought that, you know, this was kind of silly. We don't need this. And then they started to hear more and more about, oh, well, this person's friend or this person's family member was killed through drunk driving. And then that personal connection and that realization, that epiphany that, wait a second, no, this is absolutely wrong. We need to do something about it, came to the fore. And so we're now starting to hear more and more about cases. I having met parents of children who have been trafficked here domestically, and by the way, 70% of the cases approximately in Canada of trafficking are involving our own domestic citizens. Wow. Having met those survivors and also their parents and loved ones or friends of these individuals, it is personal and it is real, and it shows that we're all vulnerable and we need to actually ask ourselves if we're willing to tolerate this happening in our communities. If our friends, or if it's your grandchildren or your children or whoever it might be, are vulnerable, are we really free as a society?
Well, it raises interesting questions, you know, about enslavement as a whole. I mean, you talk about sex trafficking, you talk about other things. I mean, are we addicted to, are we slaves ourselves? What are we slaves ourselves to? If you want to ask actually more difficult, almost in a way philosophical questions that still have a practical implication. You know, am I a slave to the dollar store? You know, I mean, it sounds absurd when you're talking about somebody who is afraid for their daughter's life or their wife's life. Different kind of slavery. It's almost disrespectful to use the same word. But are we so dependent on that cheap Joe fresh purchase that we're not willing to really look at the deeper issues? I have to say, you know, even with respect to the Bangladeshi disaster recently and how many deaths and so on, it's global outrage, etc. I believe Joe Fresh is now looking at the way they're going to be doing their labor hiring and their labor practices and the factories they're going after. Quite a few labels and brands have said that they're not going to change anything, but a couple have. And I think you got to believe on some level that's a step forward. I mean, I think we could probably be farther along as a culture and as a society, but it's a good sign, isn't it?
I think so. And yeah. And we have really the blessing to work with students and university level students as well, and who are doing these things, who are starting campaigns. And I think slowly this awareness is building, and companies are actually starting to, in a way, be frightened, and they're starting to look at their corporate social responsibility more seriously. And in other cases in the States, there are now even websites that are coming up and giving them rankings. And so they're starting to get their acts more together. And I think it's only going to continue if we keep voicing our desire to be able to buy goods that are slavery
free.
There's
something there that's unsettling to me. You know, you said they're frightened. They're frightened because they're going to make less money, right? And that's a bit disturbing. Mm-hmm. So we're back to the whole capitalistic kind of approach, you know, the Milton Friedman notion that, what is it, the sole responsibility of a corporation is to increase profits, period.
Yeah, and you have know. Some people who I think rightly have suggested that the modern world was built on the back of slavery.
Right, right.
And now we're facing a choice where we need to decide, are we going to let that continue?
Do you think that slaves of the past, cultures, First Nations communities, black folk from around the world, is their time over? Like, you know, you sort of hear people saying, oh, for crying out loud, do we really need to hear about that again? I mean, get over it, will you? And I personally get kind of frustrated with that. And that's an understatement, depending on the setting I'm in. But do you think there's some truth to that? Do you think there's some value in that instead of feeling sorry for yourself, you know, you should, you know, start working on some other issue or someone? How do you feel about that?
I find that really frustrating, that attitude. I think what we need to understand, and here my bias is I'm a historian, so I think we need to understand the connections between past and present. And if we take the example of African Canadians or our First Nations people here, we tend to forget that even in the New France period, for example, when we have data about slavery even back then here in Canada, and about 2/3 of the slaves actually at that point were First Nation. And 1/3 was African Canadian.
Wow.
And you look today at our percentages, and we're estimating now that when it comes to the cases we see in Canada, which by and large are human trafficking cases, and most of which that we know about are sex trafficking cases, about 2/3 of those are involving our Indigenous people. So over the course of hundreds of years, the same community that's vulnerable has remained the same. If you look at the United States, where their huge community that was most vulnerable to slavery and that was transshipped from Africa, the African population in the States today, when it comes to human trafficking, that's the largest group that's vulnerable. So I think it's problematic because we have these communities that are vulnerable, and it's a structural vulnerability that hasn't changed, and then we're blaming them because they're still vulnerable.
Right.
And also, the individuals who are perpetrating the slavery are also, in some cases, remaining the same. Most of the time, people assume that the individuals who, when it comes to sex trafficking, are supplying the demand for that are probably from the communities, perhaps, of the individuals who are vulnerable. But that's not the case. They tend to be, as I mentioned, particularly men who have some disposable income.
Right.
And in many cases, you see them coming in from suburbs into the core areas. And often they are white. And so I think we need to start to question that aspect of this.
I remember going to Cambodia for the first time with Elizabeth, and we landed in Siem Reap, which is where Angkor Wat and, you know, all the temples are and so on, in the kind of northwestern part of Cambodia. And one of the first things we saw getting, in fact, the first thing I think I saw that I remember was a massive billboard. And I've spoken about this in my classes, and I've written about it, and I've probably spoken about it on other podcasts, but a pair of white hands and handcuffs. And the tagline was, "Remember, sex with a child is a crime." I looked at Elizabeth, and I go, do you really need to tell somebody that? Do you really need to remind somebody that? Now, I have found out since, having traveled there now for about 10 years and spent a lot of time working there, a lot of the criminals, the sexual criminals, are not white. A lot of them are Cambodian. A lot of them are Thai. A lot of them are Chinese. You know, so this is not necessarily a white Western thing. This is a problem globally.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And for the listeners, one thing that you hopefully will be happy to hear about is we now have Bill C-310 that was passed recently, which extends the long arm of our law to Canadians when they're going abroad. So in the past, we've known about sexual exploitation happening to minors in places like Cambodia that is perpetrated by Canadians who go abroad, and it's for the purpose of sex tourism, and we didn't have any way to hold them accountable, but now we do.
And wasn't there somebody convicted about a year and a half ago out west, Vancouver?
That's right, yes.
Yeah. And it was Cambodia too, wasn't it?
I think it was involving Cambodia, and then recently there was a case, I'm forgetting his name, but there was a man who had been going to Cuba and over 30 visits, and they were able to charge him now with child exploitation.
So things are changing. Why do you care, and why the hell should I care?
I care because growing up, I saw how slavery can really impact people on an individual level in my family, in my community. My grandparents on my dad's side are both survivors of slavery. Mm. And just the fears that they had of trusting people and the way in which they were treated. It's always with me, and I feel a responsibility, and I truly believe that when we talk about never again,
right,
that means action. And why we should do it and why we should care. Because again, I've through the individuals that I've met and the experiences that I've had, I really think that there's this proverb that says, you save one life, you save the world entire. And so the young woman I mentioned who was 14 when she was forced to marry, I've had the chance to know her over the past years, and she's now in freedom. She now has a family of her own. She's able to dream. And for me, that's why I do it. And I think people, the reason why you want to do it is because by giving and by focusing on others, you get something in return as well. And I think our freedom is collective. If one of us is not in freedom, and in a way, none of us are in freedom. And so Desmond Tutu, he talks about a number of things, and he often says, though, do your little bit of good where you are. And it's those little bits of good put together that overwhelm the world. I'm a strong believer in that.
Yeah.
And also,
so you believe in incremental change. You believe in the little things.
I do. And one of the studies I saw recently about how to best even fundraise or to have an impact is found an interesting result. They found that if you can have, let's say, 1,000 people give $10 a month on a steady basis, that can do amazing things for not-for-profits.
I was with a major fundraising firm on Friday, just 3 days ago, and that's exactly what they said. That's you want to get those high net worth donors that are going to write those $100,000 checks once a year. But what you really want to do is somehow engage that group that can donate $50 a year, but increase the numbers. You know, so create those monthly donors, those people that are maybe a little more engaged. Yeah. So again, for you, it was a personal connection that drew you in. Is that why you're a historian?
I think so. I think we have, again, I feel a responsibility to learn from the past in order to inform the present. And even here in Canada, in terms of our strategy to combat human trafficking and slavery, I think we can't neglect to look at the historical antecedents. And as I mentioned, the structural vulnerability that we see, especially impacting our Aboriginal and our African-Canadian communities.
So we're pretty close to wrapping up. And I want you to just maybe, before we wrap up, chat a little bit more about the Alliance and what's coming next and what you're excited about and so on. You were telling me about some things happening. And often these types of chats and articles end with, hey, here's what you can do. Well, what can I do? What can somebody do if they don't have the personal connection yet? How might they get involved?
I think each of us has a voice, and raising that voice can be incredibly powerful. And so first thing, though, is to get educated. You can go to our website, www.allianceagainstmodernslavery.org. There are some wonderful books that have come out that that go through how this is happening in Canada, where it's happening, and why. And you can also send us an email. But I think the key thing is that education piece, but then doing something. And each of us has a gift. So whether you're a writer, whether you are a photographer, whether you're a musician, whatever your skill might be, I think use it. Even telling 10 people about this is key. And then the most tragic thing I think that I hear every day is that people say, Carly, I can't do something big, so I'm just not going to do anything.
Yeah.
And I, too,
it frustrates the heck out of me.
That breaks my heart. So I think, you know, it could be, of course, you know, fundraising is always really helpful, but the awareness piece is huge. So whether it's, you know, watch a movie together about the topic with some of your colleagues or friends, or, you know, hold some kind of event where if you're a teacher, you know, get some students together, whatever it might be. I think we don't want to limit anybody. But for us, we suggest education. We suggest then getting involved. And across Canada right now, there are frontline groups that are really in need of volunteers. We have some that are working directly with victims, others who are going into schools, and others who are doing advocacy work. Because in order to change things, we need to raise awareness. It's at about 5% right now in Canada, which is pretty low.
That's pretty low.
And once we raise awareness, then we can get the commitment of our leaders. And then once we have that, that's when we can get the funding that we need to truly combat this.
So that's great. Thank you. Very helpful. How? Tell me a little bit about the Alliance as we wrap up, and what's next for you guys.
Well, we're really excited. We have set our date for our fourth annual conference, which brings together our frontline heroes, including law enforcement and survivors and NGOs, as well as researchers. And that's going to be on February 22nd, 2014, here in Toronto. We've also got a grant from the Ontario Trillium Foundation to do some research and training across the province. The next two stops for that will be in Thunder Bay and also in Windsor. And I think other than that, go to our website, check things out. One of our partners is Learning for Hope, which is a group that does work in Cusco, Peru. And we're really excited to be supporting their work there. And we've now opened a vocational center for survivors of sex trafficking in Cusco, which is a big spot sex tourism. And also, as most people know, very close to Machu Picchu, a beautiful site.
Fantastic. Thanks for joining us today. I'll say it again. Those who have been listening for the last few months, as face-to-face continues to grow, I feel like we've just barely even begun. So hopefully we'll be able to have another conversation down the road. Thanks for educating me. Thanks for bringing our listeners up to speed. Oh, and a newsletter. There's a newsletter out there. Go to the website, AllianceAgainstModernSlavery.org. I think that's about the sixth time we've pushed this website. Sign up for the newsletter. I get it. You won't get too many, and you'll get a little bit of an update of where things are, and frankly, and more hopefully, where things can ultimately be. So thanks, Carly, for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thanks so much, David.